Hello, and welcome everyone to Perimeter Institute for this special conversation. My name is Emily Petroff. I'm Perimeter's Associate Director for Strategic Partnerships, Grants, and Awards. I'm delighted to welcome you back to the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas here at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo. C'est un grand plaisir de vous accueillir ce soir à l'Institut Périmètre. Nous sommes heureux d'accueillir cette intéressante discussion. Perimeter Institute was created to be a gathering place where people can come together like we're doing tonight to ask the big questions about the universe and search for the big answers. Perimeter will soon celebrate 25 years of bringing people from all paths together, researchers, students, teachers, and the general public, to explore the fascinating world of physics. But people have been gathering on this land to discuss and debate the big questions of their time for thousands of years. Understanding our place in the world and engaging in community discussion is a human constant throughout the ages. We acknowledge that Perimeter Institute is situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, and Neutral peoples, and is located on the Haldimand Tract, the tract granted by the British to the Six Nations of the Grand River and the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation. Nous saluons et remercions les divers peuples qui nous ont précédés et nous nous engageons à agir de manière responsable et collaborative pour faire avancer la quête de savoir pour le bien de tous. Et nous remercions les Anishinaabe, les Haudenosaunee et les Neutres pour leurs accueils. It is a great, it is Perimeter's great pleasure to be hosting tonight's special event held by the Trust Scholarly Network, a conversation on artificial intelligence, should it be trusted. Across the world, we've seen a growing trend in the rise of misinformation and disinformation. And recent events, like the COVID-19 pandemic, have thrown the issue of public trust in science sharply into focus. The University of Waterloo's Trust Scholarly Network is dedicated to exploring the concept of public trust in medical, technological, and other scientific research that affects our everyday lives. One of the network's key pillars is to engage with and listen to community members to better understand why people do or don't trust scientific and technical information. This is a natural area of partnership for Perimeter Institute and the University of Waterloo, two institutes that already share a close connection. One of Perimeter's three core pillars, along with research and training, is outreach. When engaging with the public about emerging topics in science, those conversations increasingly involve artificial intelligence, or AI. We're pleased to partner with the University of Waterloo by hosting this important discussion on trust in AI. We hope that this talk will help advance understanding of the concerns and opportunities our community is thinking about when it comes to this emerging technology. So I'm delighted to introduce the Trust Scholarly Network co-chairs and welcome them to the stage. So Dr. Ashley Rose Mellenbacher is a Canada Research Chair in Science, Health, and Technology Communication and Associate Professor at the University of Waterloo. Her research investigates how genres of scientific and science communications emerge and evolve, and the ethical aspects of specialist-non-specialist relationality in the communication of complex information. She runs the CFI-funded Demos Lab, which currently focuses primarily on issues of climate communication. And Dr. Donna Strickland is professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Waterloo and was one of the recipients of the 2018 Nobel Prize in Physics for developing chirped pulse amplification. She is a recipient of a Sloan Research Fellowship, a Premier's Research Excellence Award, and a Cottrell Scholar Award, and she is a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, and she's a Companion of the Order of Canada. Professor Strickland has also served on Perimeter Institute's Board of Directors since 2021, and we're very happy to have her here tonight. Please welcome to the stage Associate Professor Ashley Rose Mellenbacher and Professor Donna Strickland.
Thank you, Emily, and welcome to the second event of the Trust Network's speaker series. I am Donna Strickland, and this is Ashley Mellenbacher, and we are the co-directors of the Trust in Research Undertaken in Science and Technology, or simply Trust Network, at the University of Waterloo. We're delighted to partner with Waterloo AI and the Perimeter Institute for this event. As Emily mentioned, our partnership is a natural one with aligned values. I'm of great pride as I'm involved with both organizations. Thanks to the Perimeter Institute for your continued partnership and for hosting in this beautiful space in the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas. The Trust Network is still a very new entity, but the momentum behind it has been enormous, and the energy and investment by our many excellent members of the Executive Committee have been central to its work. We're also thankful to the University of Waterloo's Provost, Dr. Jim Rush, who provided us with the funding to launch Trust. Trust benefits enormously from the expertise across disciplines, and our multidisciplinary efforts are supported by UWaterloo's Dean of Arts, Professor Sheila Eger, Dean of Health, Professor Lily Liu, the Dean of Science, Professor Chris Hauser, and the Dean of Engineering, Professor Mary Wells, as well as numerous leading experts in their field. We thank everyone involved with Trust. We also wanted to acknowledge the enormous work of Trust's Research Project Coordinator, Mary Cullum, who has been central to our work, and Trust's Research Assistant, Justin Steinberg, who is finalizing a report on public polling around trust in science and technology in Canada that we hope to share in the coming months. Thanks as well to the University Relations Team and the Perimeter Institute for making tonight possible.
Great. Well, welcome again. And tonight we have what promises to be a rich conversation on artificial intelligence. It's a much discussed topic that covers a complex range of technologies and applications. And we have several experts kindly joining us to talk a little bit about this tonight. But before we introduce them, we wanted to share a little bit more about Trust. And just to give you a bit of background, Trust is a network of researchers and others interested in the very idea of trust itself. And that includes why we do or don't trust someone or something, and also really thinking about specific issues around science, technology, and medicine is our focus. So we approach the issues in a few ways. In addition to the community speaker series, we also, of course, conduct research. And we also have some projects on the go, including citizen science projects, where everyday people can get involved in scientific research. So you can find out more about what we're doing either on our website or by contacting me. And of course, tonight, now we're going to focus on artificial intelligence. So it's a timely topic, and especially with the developments in recent years, and we're really trying to think a little bit about what folks are interested in hearing about that topic and why, and some of what seems to generate that interest is really a sense of unease with the quickly developing technologies. So an important part of Trust is really providing a feedback loop with the community. So that said, after tonight's lecture, you're going to receive an email and a survey where we're interested to learn about your experience tonight, but also about topics that may be of interest for future events. So now to introduce the panel and frame some of the issues, we'd like to welcome the Dean of Engineering at the University of Waterloo, Professor Mary Wells. Dean Wells is an award-winning materials researcher and passionate about creating pathways for groups of people who are underrepresented in engineering to join the profession. She was also named one of Canada's most powerful women in 2023, and she's been a key member of Trust leadership. And she'll, again, introduce some of these topics we're having conversations about, so please welcome Dean Mary Wells to the stage.
Well, good evening, everyone. And I hate it when they call you the most powerful person in the room, because what does that mean? I like influential better, but anyway, that's okay. So thank you so much for joining us tonight and to engage in a conversation. And that's really what tonight is about, a conversation between you and between some experts. And it is about thinking about trust and what that means to everybody. Moderating the group will be Jennifer Smith on my very, very far right. Jen is the engineering director and Waterloo site co-lead for Google Canada, who works towards building helpful user experiences in the dynamic landscape of generative media. Jen's career has spanned a variety of technologies, including satellite communications, image processing, laser projection, ad tech, and enterprise cloud software, contributing to markets including media, entertainment, financial services, retail, and consumer tech. I must say that I first met Jen early on when I just became the Associate Dean Outreach, and it was really her belief in me and her investment in the University of Waterloo's Women in Engineering program, the very first funding that allowed us to really accelerate what we're doing around that underrepresented group. So I always owe Jen a great debt of gratitude for that. On our wonderful, wonderful panel, we have Leah Morris. Leah, right in the almost on my left over here. Leah is the senior director at Radical Ventures, focusing on their Velocity program, research network, and responsible AI efforts, where she co-developed the open source responsible AI startups RAISE framework for early stage investors. Makun Verdi, right in the middle there, is a researcher at NASA. He is a leading earth scientist, geoinformatics expert, and artificial intelligent AI specialist. McCann's interests extend to the societal perception and implications of these advancements and promoting evidence-based decision-making. We have Lai-Chi Fan, just next to Jen. Lai-Chi is the Canada Research Chair in Technology and Social Change at the University of Waterloo and is a leading researcher studying responsibility and equity in AI. She is the founder and director of the U and AI Lab at Waterloo, which uses creative and artistic methods for enhanced equitable outcomes in AI design. We then have Anadon Sen, right there, just next to me. And Anadon is a professor of economics at the University of Waterloo, former director of the Master of Public Service Program, and currently the associate director of Waterloo Cybersecurity and Privacy Institute. Makun, Lai-Chi, Anadon, Makun, Lai-Chi, and Anadon are also members of the executive committee of our trust network, so that's why you weren't included, at the University of Waterloo. Tonight, we will be discussing a range of topics around AI. And we will have lots of time for questions, both in the audience as well as from those tuning in via the live stream. So I encourage all of you to listen, stay engaged, and contribute your important voices to this very, very important conversation. We really want to consider the concerns people have around AI technologies and their applications, the perils and promises of AI, as well as what is needed to earn the public's trust. And when we think about the future and the important role that AI will play, we have to make sure that it is what I would call human-aligned into the future. We emphasize earning trust because, as we often talk about, trust is earned through social interaction rather than given or established automatically by individuals. Please welcome our esteemed panel and our moderator.
Thank you, Dean Wells. Really excited to be here with a great group of panelists together for what should be a very interesting, thought-provoking, maybe ideally narrative-shifting, depending on which perspective we're coming from, conversation about AI and the trust in AI. Really, we're going to start and have a few conversations amongst the panel, and then we're going to open it up for the audience later, and I'll cue the audience when that's the case, and similarly for the online folks at that time. So maybe just to kick us off, and maybe fits quite nicely into the trust framework, I think that we should talk about trust and fear, because I think these are two aspects that commonly come into the conversation. McCunn, you and I had a bit of a chance to talk a little bit earlier, and you had a thought around how you kind of think about trust and fear. So I'd love to start with you and kind of kick us off with what your viewpoint is there, and specifically how you think we can build better trust amongst Canadians towards AI technology.
Well, language is the most sophisticated tool that mankind has created. It took 300,000 years for us to perfect that tool. And everything that we see around here, the technology, the healthcare, medicine, education, is a product of interaction based on the language. And now we are talking about a technology that has perfected that tool that we are so proud of. Most of the society today, they interpret AI as ChatGPT, which is basically a conversation agent. And for any intelligence that's non-human, it's obvious that it has to have some way of comprehending human language. So now here we are asking to trust or to discuss whether we can trust a technology that has perfected, but took 300,000 years for humans to perfect. And it took it maybe a year to do that, and it's continuously improving. So trust at its core, I believe, involves the willingness to be vulnerable, trusting something, some entity, some person, organization, government, to do something that you want it to do, that is basically sharing your perspective, trying to do things that are useful to you. So trust, I think, in this case, will lead to two things. One is the fear of the unknown, and the second is something that we don't completely understand. So when we are asking about trusting AI or language models in general, we are asking whether we can trust something that we don't know how it works. So there are two extremes. On one extreme, we have a segment that dismiss these language models as stochastic parrots or something that is just an elaborate or autocomplete engine. And on the other end, we have a segment of society that thinks it has got some anthropomorphic agency and intent and motivation to do something that can harm humankind. So I think we have the reality is somewhere in between these two extremes. It's not just an autocomplete engine, and it's not that your smart toaster oven is going to take over the world. So I believe we have to be realistic about the promise and the perils of this new technology, and have a balanced view about where we go with this technology and use it for the betterment of humankind, as we have used knowledge and language for the last so many years.
Thanks. Leah, I know we also had a bit of a conversation on this and the concept of the balancing the extremes and the importance of that. Love it if you would share some of your thoughts, particularly on how the your world with respect to venture capital and the searching for organizations and helping organizations commercialize this kind of technology. You know, what's the thoughts and advice and conversation there, and how should we maybe think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you also for having me here. Thank you to the Trust Network and the Perimeter Institute and the University of Waterloo. So coming from more of an industry perspective, this extreme, I've been shocked to see just the extremes that have developed in terms of the culture of artificial intelligence. So really, both of these extremes do harms, and they don't permit for us to be able to talk about that nuance that is in between. And so on one side of this argument, you have these effective altruists. They can get lumped in with safety folks and responsibility folks, people to some degree who their P or probability of doom is quite high, and think of things as quite catastrophic. On this side, we have a risk of not understanding how valuable this technology can be. And in that, I'd use the example recently of the MIT researchers who have narrowed down the haystack of finding a needle in terms of drug discovery. So being able to find a new class of compounds in order to find drugs that can be effective on drug-resistant bacteria, so MRSA specifically. And so this is something that we would like to see advanced quite quickly, and making sure that that can happen. But on the other side, to say we should accelerate everything is also not the way that I would recommend we move forward. It ignores the harms of today. It ignores the fact that people suffer from not being able to access services equally, and other harms that occur when we accelerate without thinking of responsibility. So there's a lot of value to be had in the AI narrative, and being able to command that narrative and be able to say how we should think about moving forward. And so I think the truth is not in complete trust or complete fear. It is somewhere in between, and it is much more nuanced, as you've described.
I think that's why discussions like this and a willingness of a public audience, ones in the room and those also online, to come and engage in conversations like this is so fundamental and important in moving the understanding forward, but also lessening the fear and starting to maybe open up to some of the ideas of the promises. I think the balance of the promise and the perils, I really like that phrasing a lot. And to keep on building with the theme of trust and maybe that balance narrative, we do have to address the concerns, right? And there are concerns. We just heard a few of them a moment ago. One of the topics that comes up in conversations I'm in a lot is around data privacy and user data usage as being large concerns. concerns in the realm of AI and the hold that it's taking right now. In terms of, I think probably, I'm going to come back to you, Leah, to start, and then Ananda, I'm going to come over to you on this one as well, if you don't mind. Kind of a two-part question. What do you think, what more can be done to ensure consumer data used in technology is safe and secure? And then what further policy and governance do you think needs to be addressed to making sure that this is a top priority in technological developments? And I think we're going to get two interesting viewpoints here, one from a markets and a efficiency perspective, and then a little bit from kind of the private sector's viewpoint on that balance.
Yeah, so to kick it off, privacy and data usage is not a new problem. This is something that is not new to artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence might exacerbate it, but it is not something that is a brand new problem. And so coming at things with policy that is always a net new policy might not be the best way to deal with this. And in that, when we think about policy, in some regards, we often want to create AI net new policies that address all of the ails of AI. So thinking about an AI that is transparent and fair and privacy preserving and accurate and explainable. And the reality of this is that it is not actually always possible. You can't actually maintain all of those and satisfy all of those goals in the same system. And so when we think about implementing this, there's a Stanford HAI and Reg Lab group who recently put out a report and talked about this as the, we know the AI alignment problem, but the regulatory AI alignment problem. And so when we think about creating systems, and particularly systems of regulation and policy, we need to think about, are they feasible? Are there trade-offs? And are there unintended consequences? And with this, in terms of the privacy instance, when we think about feasibility, sometimes, for instance, if we want to have the right to be forgotten, it can be unfeasible or not technically possible to be able to forget somebody. Machine unlearning is an extremely difficult problem, to the point that some people have said it's like taking ingredients out of a baked cake. It is extremely difficult and sometimes not technically feasible. So when you mandate that with policy, that can be really challenging. The other thing is trade-off. So when you talk about a privacy bias trade-off, so if we want to figure out if a technology is discriminatory, we need access to demographic data that will be sensitive. So if you're trying to do that analysis, that can be extremely difficult from a privacy trade-off with the bias. And then when we talk about unintended consequences, we can think about the executive order that's happened in the US. If you have things like compute thresholds, sometimes you can end up getting evasion from the corporate sector, where you have people creating a bunch of smaller models that they can then aggregate together that don't hit the regulatory frameworks, and or being able to find ways that you can just have a model just under that framework, that threshold, so that it doesn't hit any kind of regulatory needs. So you really have to be careful when you think about designing policy that is net new and around artificial intelligence specifically. And so I'd recommend looking at what we already have. So when we think about Health Canada, there's already an adverse incident reporting mechanism there. Things like that we can build upon can really help us. But more specifically, when we think about regulating artificial intelligence and privacy and data, there's already lots of great research in terms of this space. And then we think about the particular verticals. And what is really needed is making sure that we have artificial intelligence and technical talent within the Canadian government. Less than 1% of new AI PhDs end up in the public service right now. And so those paths into being able to make these transitions and understand what we're governing is really important. I think it was Dr. Daniel Ho who said, you can't govern what you don't understand. Mm-hmm. So it's extremely important that we have those pathways into the public service for technical people.
Yeah, I think that it's a great segue. I know, Ananda, you've studied markets, market efficiencies, many of those in regulated type verticals. Can you share some of your thoughts on what you see similar, what is dissimilar, what maybe is quite nuanced with the current application of technology that's being discussed, and what do you think is the approach we need to be taking and thinking about some of Leah's comments as well there?
Sure, no. Thanks for that. And I actually agree with a lot of what you said in terms of your content, in terms of your comments. So a big part of my career has been looking at unintended consequences. I've looked at different regulations and policies across sectors and the resulting choices made by individuals and what the effects are. But I think we need to kind of carefully think about what the problem is here. So in many cases, policies may not be good, they may not achieve their desired outcomes for a variety of reasons, but you know, the fact is that we're living in an age where I think we have insufficient policy. Now, I grant you, I absolutely agree with you on the concept of AI and data literacy. I think that's very low in the government, and I teach courses on statistics to government, so I know that, and I do agree. I do agree with you. We need more of that, and not, that's not a knock on government. It's just a fact, and I do agree with you on that. But when you look at society today, we live in a society where I think that many of us are just ending up being parts of a data set, and how are we being monetized by different companies, right? Whether it's in terms of targeted advertising or other objectives. So the point is that you have a few companies which have a lot of data and they're collecting more data. And there are significant barriers to entry for other companies. So you have barriers to innovation. So that is a fact. You have increased, incredible levels of market concentration, incredible accumulation of wealth by a few companies, really high levels of societal inequity. Those are problems. Those are issues that have to be addressed. So let's try to be a bit radical out here. When we think of the environment, in 1968, John Dales of the University of Toronto came up with the idea of pollution permits, right? Being able to pollute provided you have a permit. So basically a property right to pollution. People thought this is a crazy idea, but look at us now. The idea of carbon taxes, pollution permits, they're a foundation of sound environmental policy. So in the same vein, why can we not think of data markets? At the end of the day, why can we not move to a society where our rights to our data are clearly articulated? We have the property rights. So if we have the property rights and there is policies and regulation that allow us to collect data and maybe send it to the data trusts or data markets where we get some return, that leads to more equity. The other point is that if an individual thinks that they will get a return from an asset, they will take care of the asset being their information. Hence, they'll take more measures to secure their privacy. Because if you have poor privacy and your information gets leaked, your data is not worthwhile. You can't sell it. So it seems paradoxical, but if you think about that, there's promise out there. So what I'm advocating out here is that a radical solution to the problems we're looking at now, not conventional policy and governance.
Well, I'm definitely in favor of radical policy, and so that's no argument for me on that side. I think that there's a courage to take that approach, and I think that that is an opportunity we have as Canadians, as a Canadian economy, as a Canadian tech economy. And I would encourage everybody to think about that deeply and how they might be able to contribute. But I do think it will take some courage. With respect to, so there's the different market efficiencies that can be had. There's the compare and contrast we've talked about in terms of some of the other markets, and looking at alternate ways to think about some of these difficult problems. Lychee, I know you've spent a lot of time doing research on impacts of technology in society more broadly, and in terms of the impacts in particular across different groups and demographics. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if the concerns around misinformation, disinformation, fake, deep fakes, or this notion of data being private or not private and being accessible by others, what are some of your thoughts around information versus knowledge, as well as how we can mitigate some of these concerns that are being discussed, and that we're trying to avoid the extremes and think, you know, creatively together. What's some of your research kind of revealing that you think is important for us to understand and think about?
Thanks so much for that question. I think you pointed out really well this sort of dynamic and relationship between information and knowledge that really needs to be parsed out, because often when we're confronted and given represented information by AI systems that are commercialized, that are available to the public, Makan mentioned ChatGPT, that's often the system that people will use in a contemporary sense as an example. There's you also mentioned stochastic parrots, which is the idea that, well, it's the understanding that we have a random generation of language that compiles and is put together to make it look as if it's meaningful. But really what it is and what we're dealing with are sophisticated counting machines. They're very, very good at identifying and replicating patterns. And what they'll do is take data from the past, whether that's 100 years ago or yesterday, and make a prediction about the future. So that's information that has been presented or represented to us, but it's not the same as knowledge, which is something that we might know or that might have been justified. So I think that, first of all, to help to mitigate that is to make that distinction for users as well. There should be more, like, transparency has been mentioned. Transparency needs to be out there in terms of what is missing from that stage of how, like, what is going into the building and shaping of the representation of that information, including what's being left out, who's being left out, what kind of perspectives and histories are being omitted. I have a random example. As somebody was asking me about a project at, I believe, the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, in which 150 years of art had been used to train a machine learning system to make a prediction about what the future of art might look like. And that's a very interesting model on which and corpus to make a prediction about the future. But at the same time, you were asking about representation, especially of different demographics. If I take the last 150 years of art, not everybody's going to be represented in that. And in fact, the diversity that we might think of as being important to the future might only be present in the last 50, 60, 70 years, which leaves over half of that corpus being potentially biased because it represents other groups and other histories that have been more dominant in the past, particularly Western Western representation. So taking that into account, if I were to, for instance, make suggestions about more equitable, more diverse ways of presenting information, particularly if it's going to be misunderstood as knowledge, it's to really, for me, start at the stage of design and ask, Makan and I have also talked about this significance of thinking about this at the stage of conception, the stage of ideation, in research and development, maybe to kind of leave it with this, with a bit of a statement. If you were not thinking about that at the stage of ideation, then we are subject to ideology.
Interesting. Yeah. Makan, thoughts on that?
Yes. I feel never before in history we had a tool that had generative capabilities. So the existing framework might not work. It might break when we are talking about something like that. Never before we had, and the technology does not need to advance to a stage where it has anthropomorphic tendencies, where it has agency and motivation. It doesn't need to be. If it can pretend to be human and be convincing enough in terms of the language, the content, the structure, and the texture, if it can write poems that can move you to tears. My son turned 6 years old this month, and I asked ChatGPT to write a poem in the style of Shakespeare, and it did a pretty good job. Then I asked it, like, let's change the texture to Edgar Allan Poe. Did a good job. As humans, we don't perceive the world as it is. We perceive it through our senses. And the two primary ones are language that we hear and visual that we see. Now we have a tool that can generate both visuals, very compelling, and text and language, right? And voices too. So we don't need to be at a perfected stage to be discussing trust. or the lack thereof. We are, I think, already there. And society in general, I think, is governed by stories, by language, by what's projected out there. When you vote, you never meet the politician that you vote. You meet the story that is out there in the media. You don't know what that person is like in personal life, right? So we are already there, and there needs to be certain measures, certain controls in place before we can think about how best we utilize these technologies. And one big differentiator here is, again, not the agency, but it can pretend to be having agency. So one thing we can do in policy or otherwise is make sure that such systems declare that it's an AI that you are talking to, or that the content that was generated came from AI. That's the bare minimum we can do as a regulation. And then again, despite of that, and in a way, I'm glad that we have come to this place where we are talking about mistrust and malinformation, misinformation, disinformation, because it was already there. Think about the elections a couple of years ago. There was no AI. But I'm glad that we have reached to a point where it's convincing that we are sitting in a room full of very informed citizens. They are worried about these topics.
And I think it's almost like you read my next question, because my next question was really around, and I'll open it up to the panel in general. What are there resources being made available to help Canadians navigate and assess content, particularly with the increase in the adoption and proliferation of generative AI? I'm sure you've all seen it from very different perspectives or points of view, but there's an audience here, one online. How do we help Canadians access those resources? Where are they? What are they? Are they there?
Yeah, the two resources that I know of is, one is Media Smarts, which is a nonprofit Canadian organization educating people how to consume, what to consume, and what it's like. And the other one I know is the Canadian AI Strategy, which is the regulatory framework that they are working on. And similarly, we have in the U.S., AI Initiative Act, mm-hmm. and in Europe they have the AI Act. So there are a few that are in the works, but there is a need for all these stakeholders to play, come to the table and talk about the things and create common standards. Mm-hmm. Because just like climate change, just like nuclear non-proliferation, these are things that go beyond the borders. And then again, we have to balance because different societies, geographically, socioeconomically, are impacted differently by the promise and perils of this technology. So you have to respect the autonomy of these different groups around the world, countries, organizations, and everything, and still be fair to underrepresented and different socioeconomic sectors, I think.
Yeah. I think that some of that, we might as well jump a little bit into that regulation discussion, I think. So you mentioned a number of different initiatives that are being taken across the globe, across most industrialized nations so far, on how do we put informed and thoughtful policy onto technology that's important to regulate, too important not to regulate, but also rapidly evolving. And I think we were also talking about maybe in the green room here before the show, in the conversation, was about how is it you can create good, insightful, helpful policy when the domain is moving as quickly as it is? So just in thinking about the work being done by the OECD and the G7, a lot of the policies that you just referenced a moment ago, Ananda, I think I'd like your thoughts maybe on this in terms of, do you feel we're going in the right direction? Are you seeing any approaches that, you know, stand out to you as particularly beneficial or maybe concerning? Just share some of that on your thoughts.
Yeah, sure. I think we're moving in the right direction, but we're moving slowly. So when you think about the European Union, they basically finalized the kind of skeleton of their AI Act, but that was in December of 2023. And in Canada, we've had the Artificial Intelligence and Data Act, which was added to Bill C-27, but that's still been debated. It's still in front of the House Committee, and there's not been a lot of movement. And they're all very well-intentioned, but kind of the comments I have and the opinion of many researchers is, you know, what is the objective function out here? What are the objectives of the act really? Are we trying, how much emphasis are we putting on innovation? We should be putting emphasis on AI innovation, right? There's incredible benefits out there in terms of technology development, economic development, and returns to society. But we also have to be very cognizant of harms. So when you talk about harms, what the European Union has done is that they've defined penalties and liability for harm from high-level or high-impact AI systems. And the Canadian Act has moved in the same direction. But there's no specific definition in terms of what is exactly high-impact AI system. What exactly is harm here? It's very nuanced. Harm could be many dimensional, right? And so those gaps need to be filled in. Now the problem is that, you know, technology is evolving so quickly, our concept of harm is also changing. So I think what needs to be done is considerable skills upgrade for individuals who are responsible for drafting this legislation, leading us into the next stages, and maybe that'll help us to be a bit more specific. So that's kind of the concern out there. I mean, when you talk about specifics, there are some specifics from the Europeans that you can't hack or you can't scrape data from CCTV cameras in terms of if you're trying to create a data set based on facial recognition. I mean, that's a no-no, right? Good for that. And it's definitely, that's probably what's going to happen in Canada. So we do have some specifics, but not a lot. And I think that's what the concerns are. So when you related that to trust, I think obviously when you see this situation evolving where at one hand, we're not exactly sure what the technology can do because we're not sure what the technology is, because I think there could be better explainability and transparency in these models. I don't think it's sufficient to say, well, this is a black box and we can't explain it. We need to stop that. I mean, AI has to be transparent. It has to be explainable. Otherwise, we're not going to use it. But from the other spectrum, you know, we need to improve data literacy to get at that. And if we do that, maybe we can get into acts which evolve quickly to address contemporary societal concerns.
Yeah, I think the bold and responsible AI framework in that, you know, that maybe mental model is a good way to consider. And it's hard not to have this conversation without a continual reminder of the multifaceted dimension of all parts of the conversation and the very nuanced elements of it. It's a very difficult conversation to feel like we've moved ahead or that we've gotten somewhere that feels more definitive or concrete. What I'd like to talk about now for a little bit is we, you know, this balance of the promise and the perils, and having spoken a lot about how we think we can approach and mitigate some of the perils or the potential for peril. On the promise side, and Laichi, I think we'll start with you if we can. Coming back to that intersection between technology and society, what do you think are some of the opportunities for Canada and for society with AI?
That's a good question. I don't know that my answer will be extremely satisfying, but it is the one that I feel to be true, which is that I think that this represents a great opportunity for us to evaluate different modes and models of understanding and the ways in which we make decisions and create social and cultural valuations. by which I mean that this is an opportunity for us, for instance, I'll just use one example that I know is a lot on a lot of people's minds. Am I going to lose my job to AI? So for me, whenever I'm asked that question, it's not that I sidestep it, but I also want to address, so, you know, software engineers will ask me this question, journalists will ask me this question. I also often work with students who are writers or artists, right? So artists will ask me this question. And I do have perspectives for them, which I think also many of us could speak to. But as part of my work, I also want to reframe that conversation about, like, well, what, maybe this is an opportunity for us to talk about different types of labor, for instance, that we're not valuing, the ones that have already been kind of made obsolete or are in that direction. So self-checkout counters, robot nurses and retirement homes and hospitals, a lot of automated labor of the kinds of labor that we are not discussing in terms of their significance. I don't think that there's enough attention on that, and so we can like having this conversation about labor. If we're going to do it, maybe we should consider all types of labor, including the ones that are maybe we're not necessarily focusing on enough, in, because they get automated in things like the gig economy. So like, automation in Uber and Uber Eats and other types of apps. So the promise, to sort of come back to your question, the promise of AI in that sense, it's my answer is more critical and philosophical as opposed to pragmatic. It's meant to say that this is a good time to reevaluate our values. And that's what AI is kind of doing. And then to give you another more concrete answer or example, so, for instance, facial recognition has been mentioned. It's something I also work on, facial recognition, especially in things like predictive policing. And so, and also in more recently in the use of medical AI. So these are all really exciting opportunities, like the ways in which, for instance, maybe we can diagnose certain diseases ahead of time and do so more efficiently. That all seems to be extremely exciting, and we've seen a lot of progress in them. But also, for instance, asking what those AI are trained on, would be historical. For instance, with medical data, it would be historical medical information, which has also already been exclusionary in the past in terms of the types of studies and research that has been performed and what kind of data is being collected. So we're actually seeing already with AI, for instance, that maybe collects information on melanoma and then tries to do a diagnosis on melanoma, that there's already disparity and some misrepresentation in darker skin tones where it's not able to catch melanoma, but that's because that AI was not trained on good representative data in the first place. So that, I'm coming back to this in terms of asking about our valuations. Where is that data coming from in the first place? Why is there not enough representation in the first place? And if we are able to start at the beginning and say, like, maybe the data has to, and the representation needs to be solidified first in order for us to think about, like, the full potential of these AI. Otherwise, yes, they work, but for whom?
Jen, right. I'd love to jump in on the idea of what the opportunity is for Canada. I think the answer is the opportunity is huge. Canada had the first national AI strategy. Canada was leading the way. We have an incredible wealth of talent. I think the University of Waterloo is very aware of that. And I think fundamentally, when we look at regulation, we need to be really careful that we're not regulating things before the use cases even exist. We need to understand that innovation culture is important, but we also need to recognize these very, very real harms. So with that, I think a lot of folks, you brought up the EU AI Act. I think there's some aspects of that where they're hoping for a Brussels effect. So with GDPR, the idea that if there's regulation in one place, that a company will make a product for that place and it'll be too expensive to make separate products. We're not seeing that on the ground today, whether we want to talk about regulation, good, bad. On the ground today, there are founders, startups, trying to make companies that are foundation model companies, trying to make companies off of foundation model companies that are choosing where they are going to set up shop. And Canada could really miss out here if we are not careful about the way that we develop our regulation and we really don't make it appropriate, considering these things that I've mentioned earlier around having realistic, not high-principled clauses that they have to meet and make sure that they're grounded in the actual use cases and disciplines. We want to make sure that we're grounding it in understandings of where there already is regulation and making sure that there isn't duplications, for example, with PIPEDA or HIPAA in the case of the U.S., and there's already a lot of policy and pieces going into place to protect people in terms of their data, in terms of healthcare there. So I just think the answer is that the opportunity is absolutely massive for Canada. We've done an incredible job to date, but other countries are getting smart. They've also released different frameworks, and they're also operationalizing mechanisms for innovation in a way that I think Canada has been a bit slow to do.
I think it's great. I know it's time for us to transition, and so maybe just a bit of transition instruction, for lack of a better word. So I can see the online questions coming, so please keep submitting. For the folks who are in the room, if you have a question that you'd like to ask, there's a microphone set up on my left, your right, and we can start to kind of queue up a line there. Please come on up, and I'll start to be able to interweave questions from both the audience here as well as the one online. And then, Leah, just going as we get folks starting to move into thinking who's going to be, you know, who might be brave to be the one to come to the microphone first. There we go. All right, we got a volunteer. Thank you. I'm going to get to that question. I would love to come back as well on the opportunity for industry. You know, I read a recent report by the McKinsey Global Institute, you know, up to $4 billion of, you know, annual economic impact that can be had just by starting to incorporate generative AI and other AI techniques into parts of our businesses. And I know, Makan, from your work with the Atmospheric Science Data Center at NASA, you're already seeing this integration in some of the workflows and in some of the work that you're doing. So I want to come back to that around what you see as some of the potential, but love to open it up to the live audience first.
Hi, my name's Gurjeet. I'm a friend of Makan's. We talk quite a lot about stuff like this.
I didn't
pay him or plant him.
but I'm a fan of economics. I am a chemical engineer. I have an MBA in finance. I work for a lot of big banks. I work in real estate now, so very different experiences. But my question is for Anindya. You mentioned that, you know, organizations tend to consume a ton of data. They have access to data. I think the lack of trust comes from the fact that a common guy like me, we don't have access to data where we will use AI for our benefit. I see banks using our data to provide us services. Yeah. We see telecom companies. Telecom in Canada is one of the most expensive in the world. They use our data. They could see that I bought 5 Air Jordans in the past 5 months. So instead of pitching me a $60 plan, they could pitch me an $80 plan based on my patterns. So how do we make sure that a guy like me can trust AI? Because there is no tool for me to gauge, you know, the monopolies, if I may put it that way, that the two providers of telecom mostly, maybe 5 banks that I can work with. I don't even have a tool to read the terms and conditions myself, right? Like when a bank makes me sign, I as a person do not have a way to negotiate with a bank. So how does AI help a person like me if they help me read the terms and, you know, maybe there's a language model that helps summarize it in 5 points? Maybe that's when there's going to be a little bit more trust coming in from people. Otherwise, people like myself and a lot many would try to shy away and would want to keep away from these technologies, no matter how much they can help in the science of technology or medicine. A caveat to that, or maybe a way to think about that is, while AI can help you find better ways of curing a disease, there could be another company who's trying to find a way around pitching a better medicine to you or a more expensive medicine to you. So for a person like me, I love technology, I'm all for it, but obviously, you know, the fear is still there. How do you think that, you know, a person, a common man can, or that the fear can be alleviated?
You know, if I had to respond to the entire question, it'd be a thesis, but those are good. that was a great question, and I thank you for that. I think that it comes back to what I was saying in the beginning about being in a society where, are we moving towards being in a society where everyone is a data point and how are we monetized, right? And I think that what you're talking about is the imbalance, that if you're a firm, you have a large amount of resources and data, and then they can use it to maybe find out what your preferences are and what you'd like. And, you know, there's a market transaction, and there's nothing wrong in that. If you benefit from that and they benefit, then that's fine, right? That's how markets work. But I think that what I'm a big believer of is democracy, data democracy, right? So how can we have an ecosystem where there's a large amount of public data, and then you can use a generative language like ChatGPT, right? To say that, look, this is the question which I have, which is of private interest to me, and it's to you. Can you go access these data sets and tell me what your opinion is? So then I'm armed with better knowledge, and I have a better bargaining position to go out and make decisions. And there's, you don't have that knowledge imbalance now, right? Now, is that kind of a pipe dream? I don't think so. And the example I'll give you quickly is that I've started experimenting with ChatGPT. So when I teach statistics, and by the end of the course, when I come to regression models, I give students a take-home assignment. Here's the data set. Tell me what the story is behind the data. What are your conclusions? So it'll take maybe 2.5 hours, 3 hours to do this assignment. Now when I use ChatGPT, I was actually doing it last night. I fed in the data, and I got the answer back in 2 minutes, right? So this is an example of productivity. Now, I'm sure some of the answers were off, but I was pretty impressed with the visuals which came out. So what I'm trying to say is that if we somehow get together and understand how best to access these huge data sets, and that they're not in the trove of just some companies, but for the public, and the public can then use a language like ChatGPT to access them and get answers, I think that's very powerful. I hope that answered your question somewhat. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think to expand a little bit further, and I'd open up to the panel, the essence, I think, of that question and some of what you're saying, Anadao, is really around walled gardened data, or data sets, for that matter, or private data versus public data sets, and the boundary between them.
Correct.
And how pliable or maybe fluid those boundaries are. And I don't believe there's a construct for it yet today that manages it perhaps as fluidly as you would like based on what you think the model is that you're communicating. But for the other panelists, I mean, thoughts on this? Because this is a big part of the conversation, right? Where is the data and what is the access to that data? The tools that are being built on top provide interfaces and allow many more people to have access and have a conversation or a dialogue about the underlying data. But what do we think about this concept of more open data is maybe what I would call it.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk about this, actually, because I'm giving a talk tomorrow on about open access and accessibility. And for me, and it relates to some of the conversations and conceptions of AI in terms of black boxes, so not understanding how they're made and then also not understanding how they come up with the content that we are given and we're supposed to maybe take for granted. A lot of this has to do with the term literacy has come up, so definitely more technological literacy, a lot more AI literacy. But one thing that can be done, and I think this can be done with multiple stakeholders, is greater accountability from the developers and industry, greater accountability in terms of governance and regulation, and greater accountability also on the users to be realistic about the limitations. So as much as like in an ideal world, it would be great to use these systems in order to answer our questions and aid and augment the ways in which we can understand things. I think understanding where they may fall short is just as important in order for us to use them effectively. So, for instance, so the term black box, for instance, I had previously in another project examined the application programming interface of an AI system, which means that I kind of looked at the ways in which the system worked, how it had been designed, and how I could build things with the system, which is fantastic. APIs are increasingly less and less open in terms of access. The corporation behind GPT, the GPT model, is called OpenAI. That's an ironically named company at this point. And they didn't start out closed. They were open until, I believe, GPT-3, their third model, which I believe came out in 2020.
maybe 2021. Thank you very much. And then access to their API. So the whole model was open source, which is great. That means community members could come in and work with it, learn from it, build with it, and help to build it. And once it became sophisticated enough, then the API was available through Access for Pay. So rather, you could access it if you paid for it. That would actually stifle a lot of my research. If I can't access the APIs, if I can't access the design, and putting it behind a paywall actually exacerbates this problem because now I understand less. And the more we do that, like GPT-4, the API is also available, but a lot of these things are being put out of access, whether for financial reasons, political reasons. There are many reasons, but I don't love the trend of monetization. It's definitely making it more and more of the term like black box, and less of what I try to lean towards with designers, a gray box. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to give me everything. Tell me what the limitations are. That's good enough for me to tell the stakeholders across the way, the developers, the moderators, the people in governance, and the users. They should know at every stage what's not there. Not just what this can do that's so great, what can it not do? And that's just as important to keep in mind.
I really love this concept, and I think Percy Lang has said open legibility. Yeah. I think it's a really interesting concept as opposed to, when you just say open source actually is a very specific term that is more applicable to software. And I think when you think about it, you can open the weights, and that can be a different thing than actually opening data sources. And we have to understand that industry really is leading this conversation. In 2022, there was 32 significant foundation models created. I think only three of those came from academia. So we need to understand what that looks like and what legibility looks like. And also within academia, NURBS this year, which is a massive research conference, the Neural Information Processing Conference. And so when we look at the AI conferences, we are now talking about how do we do reproducibility and making sure that the scientific method can be continued on in the future and making sure that we can actually check results. It is extremely important that we are able to do that. And so there must be a way to move forward without just totally closing things off and allowing open legibility.
I'm going to pause there. We have a question from the audience that's come in looking at, should there be concern around increasing polarization on the political side with respect to how AI is being used and where we're seeing it? I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this year we have more global elections than any other year in history. Yeah. So, great question. Thank you for the person online who posted it. I'm going to start. I'm going to come to you, McCann. Go for it.
So it ties in back to the question about privacy and data and personal data. I'm generally a very optimistic person, both for technology and for humanity. But I think the expectation of privacy in today's day and age, that ship has sailed long time ago. Now we have a digital profile of every person in the room. And with the generative AI, they can steer your opinions and your emotions in a certain way. That ship sailed with the advent of Instagram, TikTok, when we traded privacy for small snippets of our life and giving other people window into what we think, how we think, why we think like that, what are our preferences. But going forward, maybe there is a way of containing, regulating, governance, or something. But regarding the polarization, yes. With AI perfecting the language and the tools of rhetoric, and argumentation, convincing. It has at its disposal all of humanity's knowledge and ways and instruments of how to convince people. How do stories move? How do characters move in stories? All the books that have ever been written. It's a difficult task, but it's good to have conversations and be more worried, actually paranoid. Is probably a better word to address. I think that's needed. But yes, polarization, yes, increasingly more. And the regulation, the irony here is anyone with a laptop can create. use this tool to create things that we are worried about. That's a real problem. With nuclear, with climate change, it's a global phenomenon. There are lots of regulations. You can't do that in your garage, right? But this is something that you can do sitting in a cafeteria.
And I think that's one of the untapped yet potentials and promises of AI is its ability to help everybody be able to be a creator if they wish and to be, an author or create knowledge that hasn't yet been created. I think balancing the paranoia, fear, with some optimism is probably, again, going back to the conversation we had earlier around balancing the extremes, is definitely the call to action and a challenge for everybody, but definitely a call to action. And go back to the live audience. Go ahead.
Hey, Jen.
Hi, Chris.
So awesome to see so many friends up here talking about this amazing topic. So thank you to Perimeter and University of Waterloo pulling this together. Most of the conversation has been around how do we regulate people that are largely good actors, good intent. Mm-hmm. There's another whole side of trust in AI that relates to how bad actors are likely to use it. And maybe picking up on the previous question, this week, on a very cold night in Iowa, 110,000 people went out to vote. 50,000 of them voted for the former President Trump. 20% of those people that voted for him were college educated, and 70% of them earnestly believe he won the prior election. We talked a lot about social and social networks and how that influenced those last two elections and this idea of deplatforming people that were saying things that were not true, and none of that seemed to work. And so I guess the question is, should we be worrying about bad actors as much as the regulatory frameworks, and what things are likely to come to bear to protect us from bad actors in AI?
Yeah. Anybody like to start? And we're always going to have bad actors, and we always have had bad actors. And I think that there are lessons that we can extract from with the current situation and the current evolution of the technology that are important for us to look at. But I have a thought on this, but I really would love to just hear the expert panel's discussion around how do we mitigate, prevent, maybe moderate some of the bad actors.
Yeah.
And there's a very similar conversation or question on, is there a point in regulating when you're still gonna have bad actors that don't follow regulation, right? And maybe we can have a bit of a perspective on that as well.
I'd like to just point to the point that I said earlier about looking at the regulations that we already have and not needing it to make an AI piece. People always talk about the battle between open and closed models in terms of safety. Open models are perceived to be more safe, but perhaps dangerous because of the fact that anybody could use them. Closed models, safe because they're closed and can monitor the usage, but potentially easy to get past any guardrails you put in there given the right prompts. So perhaps if you have a concern about bioweapons, instead of looking at open-closed models, we look at regulating the infrastructure and places that make it possible to make bioweapons, the things that you would physically need in the physical world. So I think an example of, in terms of there's bad actors, AI is just part of the tool, and there's a whole other infrastructure that they can use. Doesn't answer the question, it's not super satisfying, but it is definitely part of a system if we're going to look at how bad actors act in the world.
I think that that's a very wide-ranging question in terms of what is a bad actor and what is a bad action. And I think that I agree with you that AI is a tool, right? And so if we go back to Chris's question, and maybe if I'm correct on that, the bad actors here are people or individuals who use AI-powered social platforms to spew opinions and spread misinformation or disinformation in order to push a certain view, a point, or to ensure a certain electoral outcome, right? So that is just one simple example. So I'm going to stick with that example. And it's difficult to come to a solution for that because when it comes down to trust, right? Who do you trust? And when you have social media platforms, which basically are powered by third-party advertising, so the longer you keep someone there, you know, the more you could hit them with ads and the more money you make, then you just like send them messaging which they enjoy and they believe in, right? So then the question is that what is an antidote for that? What could be a good policy alternative? And I was thinking that, you know, on the vein of radical ideas, could we think of a government or international run social media platform or web service where if you use those services, you're not being monetized, right? So if I go to this special web service, I put in a search, I get the results, that's knowledge, that's information, that should be a basic human right. But when I do that, it's my information is not being collected and sold. And it's the same thing with media platforms that I can use and where I feel protected. So, but then I'm thinking that yet we live in a world, and this is what you brought up, that, you know, hey, I want this cool app on my phone and I'm gonna give up all my information to it. And I have no idea what it's doing in the background. Oh, the government wants to sort of help me in downloading the COVID app, so, you know, in order to make sure that COVID's not spread. I'm not gonna do that. I'm not gonna share my information with the government, right? I mean, that's a society we live in, right? So that's the point, that there's no clear answer to that, because we don't seem to be trust any agency out here. And so this is something which we have to reflect upon more to kind of get at solutions.
I think on like bad actors, I'll go back to Leah's point earlier about using existing frameworks. And one framework that comes to mind is the pharmaceutical medicine industry. Mm. We can do only so much on the consumer side of technology. We can probably do something on the creator side of technology. You don't see drugs being developed in the garages. Or even if a drug is developed that is promising, it doesn't hit the market right away. There are rigorous testing. It has to go through some sandbox testing. So maybe like those are the kind of frameworks that we can probably leverage to test these technologies very rigorously before it's out in the open. Because even though anyone with a laptop in a cafe can use this technology, but you need big corporations, big money, big resources to create this technology. So those are, I think, point origination, like the point of origination are only few and far, which are easy to regulate. So I think if we apply the same kind of instrument that we apply on pharmaceutical industry, we can probably get somewhere in terms of what is available and whether just because someone can create it in the lab or big supercomputers does not mean it has to be released to the public, I think.
Leah, we talked a little bit before the session on maybe a bit of a misunderstanding or a misconception around motivation of private sector and private industry. And you're drawing a really good distinction here, I think, Makam, with respect to creation and then consumption and usage. And is it a bad thing to have creation have concentrated folks and individuals within it? Some of the conversation around how do you manage or mitigate bad actors is around ensuring that the concentration is higher of the good actors. So that's, you know, that's part of it. But if we think about it from a private sector perspective, and I'd love you to kick us off here, Leah, if you can, on is it a bad thing? Is it a bad thing to have the concentration on the creation side? Be largely within what has already been pointed out as a natural incumbent set of organizations and or institutions that, you know, have already been largely in the space or been in it for a long time, where the democratization of the consumption becomes the value potential. What do you think on that? And again, it's a balanced question, but I also think it's a little bit about how do we address the bad actor or potential for bad actor question.
Yeah, I think a great point has been made fundamentally that it takes a lot of resourcing to be able to make anything really largely impactful. What's phenomenal is we live in a world right now where anyone can really get a GPU and start creating and do something on a small scale. High school students, anyone can really start creating with artificial intelligence today. But to scale up and to be able to do something at the size of some of these big tech corporations, you really have to have massive resourcing. And so at Radical Ventures, we have created the Responsible Artificial Intelligence Startups Framework Raise. It's on GitHub. The whole point is that it's open source. I encourage you to take a look at it. We've taken a bunch of taxonomies of harm and put them through basically a framework that's a risk management framework, nothing that you haven't seen before from project management perspectives, that thinks through the impact, what could happen to somebody and the likelihood of the stakeholders having that impact on them, and then thinking through mitigation. So I think there's an interest from the private sector to be asking these questions. This framework came about because the people creating that we invest in, the technical founders, are asking us, how do I think through this technology being responsible? When I'm creating and I want to ask you for a ton of capital to make this happen, how am I going to think about the impact it has? Because I'm a technical person, but I don't necessarily have the background in the social responsibility area. And so there's lots of great people thinking about the taxonomies of harm. There's a Google research paper that came out. They have the resources to think about this, put together really interesting and comprehensive frameworks that help us understand. And so I think there is incentive and interest in creating in the private sector in a way that accounts for responsibility. And so encourage you to take a look at that framework. We are always interested in people contributing, and then you can weigh in on exactly this question, I think.
Great. I just want to do a check in the live audience, because I wasn't sure if the folks on the stairwell, are you coming up to the mic or? All right, yeah, come on down, everybody. I wasn't sure if it was like, you know, a side participant group or go for it.
Right. Well, I'm a computer science student, as well as someone who's quite interested in new technologies. And especially with AI, because that's something that I'm working personally. And so far today, there's been some great discussion already about trust, policy, responsibility, and equity in AI, particularly in the context of generative AI. And I also love the fact that today, in today's conversation, there's also like voices heard from the general public, bringing as many stakeholders as possible into today's conversation. Now, my question is related to policy. In the realm of generative AI, where rapid advancements are happening, how can governments, industries, and research entities collaboratively develop policies that ensure responsible innovation and equity without unduly stifling technological progress or compromising competitive advantages compared to those of looser or no policies? And how do we strike this balance effectively?
I'm going to offer him my seat, because I think that he deserves it based on that thoughtful question. Thank you for the question. I know we've been talking about facets of that exact question throughout the discussion. Any extra thoughts? I think the part I would pick up on there was maybe the, and this has always been the case, right? The most, this is my opinion, but I think there's lots of historical evidence of it. Collaborations between academia, the private sector, the public sector are fundamental when it comes to achieving what we've been talking about achieving, which is, you know, literacy, information availability, constructive frameworks, good regulation policy, et cetera. So I think maybe that would be where I would center maybe some of the response, because we haven't really touched on that component of it. So kick it over to my esteemed panel here on who might want to start that one out.
So is this kind of looking at what good policy is for generative AI? Is that what we're focusing on?
I think he's looking at how do we pull all the people together who care to do it as best as possible. Was that, we've left the mic.
Yeah, that's one point, but also from a technological progress perspective, how do we ensure that these policies also don't restrict what we actually develop?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so the balance on, you know, policy being informative and constructive and helping with innovation and advancement versus...
No, it's a great question. Theory, yeah. I think the point is, look, at the end of the day, when you think of AI, huge benefits in terms of innovation. There are huge benefits to society, right? But there's possibility of harm. So the question is that how do you maximize that total surplus to society? That's the point. So we need that framework. Now, unfortunately, that framework isn't there yet, very clearly, right? Because it's a very difficult question. And we can talk in generalities. There's ways to do it. If you had some type of mathematical function which could quantify benefits and costs, but I think that the problem is for something like generative AI, we're only getting to know what it could be, what could be done with it, right? So unless you have an idea of the full range of benefits, that's difficult to do. What I think would be a good alternative focus is where is the data coming from and how are the models being trained? If you address that satisfactorily, then that's a huge chunk of the problem there. And the reason I'm bringing that up is that when you talk to the community a lot, there's a great knowledge of, well, this is ChatGPT and what we might do with it. But what's sort of under the radar is how were the models trained? And there's these interesting articles which say a lot of the models were trained using workers in Kenya who were paid low wages and exposed to really bad images, right? And that is necessary for training the model, because the way generative AI models work is you have to make sure the data being fed in is clean. But these were workers who also suffered trauma, and there is research backing that up. And why I'm bringing this up is this is an example of a tool which is being used and has led to great benefits, but there is a cost there in developing the models. We can't do that. That's almost like AI colonialism, right? Let's export it out and let's the bad stuff being developed somewhere else. That's not definitely a world which we want to live in. So, you know, I think that we can't answer everything, but looking at how the data is being collected and how the models are trained is important.
Okay, we're going to go into a 30-second response rapid fire. Just if I did the count right and the clock right, we got about that much to go here. And I want to be respectful of both the opportunity, but also the time that people have invested. So we're going to get the next question live in the audience mic here, and then we're going to do a 30-second response.
Ready.
The other time.
Or less.
Got this.
Okay.
There is a reception afterwards.
Go for it.
Continue.
Yes. Yeah, actually, thank you. That's a very great point. Yeah, thanks. That's really helpful. We will all be around outside afterwards and can carry on a lot of this dialogue. And I also know, I think we'll address some of the online questions that we're not getting to as well separately. So go ahead.
So my question kind of dovetails with what was just being talked about in the pursuit of like resisting overregulation and like making the good stuff still happen. Should we be looking at rights to audit the things that are being created with our data, be it personal data or behavior online or our creative works and intellectual property? And should we be allowed to audit the things that are being used to make decisions about us?
15 seconds, Leah.
Auditability, if I understand the question correctly, audits can be excellent, but they can be really problematic if they become like a version of greenwashing and rubber stamping. So there's lots of excellent opportunities for auditability. Have I misunderstood? I see your face. It's potentially me misunderstanding.
Should I, as somebody who contributes to the data set, be allowed to audit the things that I'm contributing to? And like, could there be like a journalistic kind of protection that saves us from overregulation?
We're going to pass that one to the outside event after.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. But thank you for the, I just want to allow some of the other questions in. So that one we're going to park for a follow-up outside. We're going to try and get two or three more in here. And then we got to pass it back to Ashley.
All right. I'm Liam. I'm a grade 12 student. And unfortunately, this question is not great for the rapid fire round. It's difficult, but I heard the word meaningful being tossed around in the panel earlier. And my question is, at what point does the output of a predictive model become meaningful? Because, you could argue that neurochemically, a brain is very similar anatomically to a small neural network, so at what point is the whole greater than the sum of its parts?
I have a, like, maybe, oh. Yeah.
I think that's subjective because what's useful to you might not be useful to someone else, and your level of expertise and knowledge might be different from someone else who's consuming the output of the model. So one model that is very sophisticated might not be very useful for someone who is expert at that, but it might be very, very useful for someone who is at a very basic level.
And if I can add a 5-second answer, I think the point at which we're training that in a way that it's not just quantitative but also qualitative will help make it meaningful.
When it answers a societal question which hasn't been addressed yet.
Thank you for being here. It's amazing, right, with the grade 12. Thank you for telling us you were a grade 12 student.
Thanks for being here.
Okay, last. I think this might have to be our last question. So for the gentleman who got his question non-answered, just stay right there and I'll come find you in a minute.
From the earlier conversation on the pragmatic side of, am I gonna lose my job? I'm 2 years from retirement, so I'm comfortable, I'm safe. I'm gonna be okay. But my son is in the audience and this week he's submitting his application to UAW. Mm-hmm. AI, ChatGPT are promoted as ways to get simple works done, base code in the background, review basic contracts, complete simple tasks, to allow humans to focus on being experts, specialize in their fields. Your specialists in your field, say the top 5%. How is my son going to do the 95% to get to the 5% to become that specialist when industry is simply going to use these tools to avoid having paying people to do them?
This is related to my answer that was very quick just now about the insignificance of qualitative training as well. I think also because I'm coming from the humanities and social sciences, I understand that there's a need for critical training as opposed to just performative training and knowledge. It's not useful to be performative here like a machine. We are not machines. We have the capacity to think through problems. Just, I'm happy to talk to you about this further as well. I think primarily I want to help my students, and I know that there have been some questions about education as well that have appeared on the screen. I want to help my students understand that this is a tool like a calculator or I think chainsaw has been thrown around sometimes. You will hurt yourself if you don't know what you're doing. But in regard to comparing it to a calculator, if I don't understand the math, the calculator is only going to help me so much. And that's what leads me to be the person who's yielding that tool as opposed to it doing my job for me. So that's the real framework I would want to push as an educator, as a researcher, and as somebody who works with younger people going forward.
Thank you for embedding the educator perspective and viewpoint in there. We do have to wrap, so I'd like to ask Ashley if she can come back up and maybe wrap up for us. Thank you to all the panelists.
That was good.
All right. Thank you, Jen, and thank you for moderating such a rich discussion. Thanks as well to the panel, Lychee, McCon, Leah, and Anandao. Your insights and expertise were incredibly valuable, and thanks to the audience as well, both here and online. And thank you for all of your questions, your insights, and your perspectives, as well as your time tonight. So, and thank you once again to the Perimeter Institute for their partnership in this event, and of course, the lovely space, and thanks also to Waterloo AI. We hope to see you at the next Trust event, which will be on May 14th, and information about that will be shared on our website once it's available. And of course, the Perimeter Institute and Waterloo AI have listings for their events on their respective websites. Once again, thanks everyone, and have a great night. And if you weren't able to get your question answered, these are important to us, so please, you can send an email to community.relations@uwaterloo.ca. So I'll say that one more time, and someone will get back to you from that. Community.relations@uwaterloo.ca. You can send those questions that maybe weren't answered. And again, thank you, everyone.